Gordon McKay and his brother Duncan, who was an attorney. And Gordon ran the Deschutes title and insurance company. And but the father had been a banker and had been the mayor of Bend and just been on the school board. And the McKays had a big work ethic. And little Mrs. McKay, who was Scotch, was somebody that Sam greatly admired, too. And then there was Jack Weddle, who family founded the Weddle store that was a landmark in Bend. Dutch Stover, who with his wife ran the theater in Bend. He had come up out from Ohio. He was an O-man at Ohio State, played football, and was a state legislator. And his wife Ruth, who had come from Seattle. They were pretty social folks, and right in the middle of the whole society thing, were great friends with all these people. There was one young woman that's still living, and her name is now Deal Schneider, but she was Gay Hamilton, and her father was a judge in Bend, and one of the prominent members of a lawyer group in Bend. And then there are people that I never knew all that well, but heard them talk about, who became colonels and generals, and there was young Bob Thomas, who is the patriarch now of Thomas Sales and Cadillac Chevrolet Buick dealership in Bend, and is a retired general. So they turned out to be very solid, substantial citizens. Gordon became a state senator, and. But they all told tall tales of the comings and goings and the escapades back and forth as they carried on their kind of freewheeling social life in Bend. And then, of course, the war took them all into the service. And Sam's father, as I may have said earlier, was one of the preparedness people in the Bay Area. And he could see that war was coming, and he insisted that Sam get a commission in the Corps of Engineers before something might happen. So Sam was a commissioned officer, I think, in 1937, though he never took ROTC. And he graduated in forestry from the University of California, and knew some of the early day people who were the leaders in the industry. Sam's father, having been involved in the Pacific Lumber Company through the Stanwood Murphy family, and the Union Lumber Company up at Fort Bragg, and the founder of that was Otis Johnson. They were no relation, but great friends. And Sam and Russell Johnson, who was his contemporary, became good friends. Russell was a little bit younger than Sam. And then this Jack Wood, as I say, and then the Dance, Tom Dant went back to San Francisco and owned a building up there near the Pacific Union Club. So Sam kind of, again, hadn't formed an identity of his own. And that's why he remarked many times that there were two or three things that created real turning points in his life. One was his being in the Army and being on his own and being his own man and getting promoted on his own and working for somebody other than his father and doing what his father looked on with great respect and doing it well. And then maybe another thing, of course, was marrying me, which changed his life considerably because I wasn't a part of any of those worlds that he was in. And then his being elected to the legislature on his own and actually being elected by people that didn't really care who he was and winning against what everybody said to him were odds that he couldn't beat, that he had all the wrong qualifications. Being elected or appointed to the board of the National Association of Manufacturers, where he was on his own, and then probably electing to live in Central Oregon instead of doing what might have come naturally to him. I mean, other activities would have taken over had we lived in Portland, or worse, had we, I shouldn't say worse, or more if we had lived in San Francisco. And he really had no desire to go back to San Francisco because he didn't want to try to replicate his mother and father's life in San Francisco. He had no interest in it at all.
I thought he was about to go back there at one point.
No, not to live, okay. Ever. That never was something that we considered seriously. We were going to live in Portland because Sam felt very much at home here in Portland, and also because I had some roots in Portland and we had friends in Portland and we could have been a part of the Portland community, which by this time Sam really felt more comfortable with, I think, than in San Francisco, except when he was in the midst of the Bohemian Club thing. And then his becoming captain of his camp at the Bohemian Club and being named to that position by his fellow
I don't
Bohemian
the
Club.
Bohemian Club too well. What sort of an experience?
Well, I don't know
there?
That much about it. It gets very bad press very often because it's supposed to be the home of the rich and powerful of the whole country. And of the power base of the country, the industrial, the political, the social, the artistic, the whatnot. But as I understand it, the Bohemian Club was formed to back artists in the San Francisco area. And so they've always had artist members who are members because of who they are in the artistic or musical or acting, theater, or whatever world. And then Herbert Hoover was one of the members of the Bohemian Club, and they own these acres on the Russian River up in north of Napa and Sonoma and in that wine country up there. And it's beautiful redwood country, those great big gorgeous redwood trees, and then that rushing river that goes through it, and all these thousands of acres that the Bohemian Club just acquired. And so every summer they have what they call their encampment, and for 2 weeks, three weekends.
It is an outdoors? So
it's outdoors, yes. But they've divided into little camps, and the one that Sam's father belonged to, and which Sam belonged to from the time he was a young man, was called the Pelican Camp, and that's because of Sam's father's connection with Klamath Falls and the White Pelican Hotel in Klamath Falls that the father and some of those other San Franciscans built in Klamath Falls. And they had, as their mascot, of course, a pelican, and they had a stuffed pelican that came from Klamath Falls that was the... But it was a club originally of... mostly artists and some rather famous musicians, singers like John Charles Thomas, and there was a sculptor by the name of Haig Padigan, who's fairly well known, and others who belonged to it. But during the time of Sam's father was never the official captain of the camp, but he was described as kind of the squirrel who always was scurrying around and helping to bring in people who were Bohemians, but of the group of industrialists. And it was during the time that Sam's father was pretty active in the thing that they brought in such people as Ward Kennedy, who headed up the Willys Overland Jeep Corporation, somebody from Chrysler, and I've forgotten his name. Then Mr. Kendrick Slage Locke, and Mr. Crawford, Thompson Products, that later turned into TRW. And then when somebody else succeeded Sam's father as captain, and then after he died, his name was Starkweather, Sam was elected captain. And during his time, he and two or three other people from San Francisco decided they needed to revitalize the Bohemian, and they turned more to people who were in the scientific, scholarly, academic, writers, that kind of group. And it was during that time that, well, General Doolittle was, of course, somebody who didn't fit the latter category, but Dr. Luis Alvarez, who was a Nobel Prize winner, was one of them they brought in, and Dana Levitt, who was the head of Transamerica, and there's a young man whose wife is an architect, and he was a MacArthur scholar. Rich Muller is his name, and he and Dr. Alvarez promoted the theory that what killed all the dinosaurs off was a comet descending or some great body, and the dinosaurs all disappeared. It's a highly controversial subject, but it's still being argued by the geologists and geophysicists and whatnot. And
well, Sam was wanted to change the composition of it.
Well, they just wanted to have more people who were younger.
He just in charge of Camp Pelican, or was
yes?
He,
no, that's all. And he never was an officer in the Bohemian Club.
So he nonetheless had the opportunity to change the composition of this one.
Well, he and two or three other people inside the camp, one of them being this retired OBGYN, another one being a man by the name of Wickman, Walt Wickman, I think that was his, Wickett. And he was an old San Francisco family, and he was a physicist who taught at Menlo Park and was artistic at the same time.
But why did Sam want to make this change in the composition?
Well, he and Ralph just decided that they were losing many of their industrialists. They were all older. They were of Sam's father's generation, and many of them were dying or becoming incapacitated. One of them was the man who was at one time billed as one of the wealthiest men in the world. He was a shipping magnate from New York. Daniel Ludwig was another one. And his health was very bad, and he wasn't able to attend so much. And so they just decided they needed some more San Franciscans. The Bohemian Club frowns on having too many San Francisco members. It's more an international group. And so each year, each one of those members can bring a guest. And so they have interesting guests. One of the members of the Bohemian Club was the man who invented the kind of clock that is a perpetual kind of a thing, and he's nationally known, and his name escapes me at the moment. Another one was an official of Pan American World Airways who also was very well known and had, among other things, one of the greatest doll collections in the world and had been stationed in Japan. They just had Bo Calloway, whose family was the Calloway mills, textile mills in Alabama. Ralph Stinson, this retired OBGYN who just recently died, came from Georgia or Alabama, and he was well known also in aviation circles. He trained the fellow that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, and I remember he just happened to be at our house because he was a member of the board when they celebrated the anniversary of it, and Ralph was standing in front of our TV set in Redmond looking at these pictures and of this man who flew the plane, and they were asking the man who flew the plane, did he feel guilty about it? And Ralph said, he better not say I feel guilty, and he didn't. He said, no, we did what needed to be done, and we saved thousands and thousands of lives, both civilians and military, we think. And we warned them repeatedly, and they wouldn't listen.
Do you remember your reaction when you heard the news of the dropping of the A-bomb?
No, I guess I was just more concerned that we were going to lose so many American fellows if they had decided to invade Japan. And by this time, I guess I knew Wally Cooper a little bit better. That this was this commander that I mentioned that put together in England with these other maverick kind of physicists and chemists, the underwater demolition team, and knew how deadly landing on those beaches was for all of us, and knew that to try to invade Japan would have been just catastrophic. But, and of course, everybody was aware of General Doolittle's raid over Tokyo, and that somehow that was the only way we could stop the Japanese from continuing to do what they did. And there were still people, and there still are, who were involved in Pearl Harbor, who will never forgive them for what they did. Others, and we've had much publicity about it, have recognized it was a product of the times, and somehow that's the way it was, and you did the best you could, but we had to prevail, both places. Only we took on two huge superpowers at the same time and had a very unreliable ally in the Russians, the Soviet Union. And they'd gotten caught trying to figure out pragmatically what was best for them, and it didn't work. So I don't know. That the horror of what it would mean was not driven home to me until my brother and I visited Hiroshima and saw those pictures and saw those letters from the United States trying to get through to the high command of the Japanese to warn them that this was, that we had the capability of doing this and we would do it if they didn't cease and desist. And they wouldn't, and showed their responses to it, so on. So I guess you just don't realize what it means in human terms. We saw some of the people who were brought back here for treatment and how horribly burned they were.
Yeah. Well, it was such a shock. I mean, it was such an unexpected surprise.
I know.
To hear the word of it.
But you know, there was Harry Truman. I remember being at Astoria when Roosevelt died, and we were supposed to be very apolitical in the Navy, and I remember voting, but I don't remember anybody much talking about anything, and Roosevelt was our leader, and we weren't going to change horses in the middle of the stream and all that sort of thing, but that he was obviously terribly ill when he ran for that fourth term and should never have done it from the point of view of his own health and everything, but down there at Astoria, the reaction when they heard that Roosevelt had died was, hooray, you know? And then somebody said, but oh my God, Harry Truman. And then somebody else said, yes, but thank God it's Harry Truman and not Henry Wallace. And because we could have had Wallace for vice president, and he was pretty much an avowed socialist. And Roosevelt was such a towering ego that he didn't bring Harry Truman in on almost anything. And I can remember Mr. Truman just being, and Mrs. Truman just overwhelmed by all of a sudden he is president. And he had to make terrible decisions, and he didn't have the background for doing it. And he moved in under the shadow of this fallen, just almost God to a lot of people. And I remember, and I can't quote it exactly, but a statement to the extent that there are probably 6 million people in the United States that are better qualified to be president than I am, but I am the president, and the buck stops here, and this is the way it is. And we credit him now for a lot of gutsy decisions, which he did because he didn't have any other choice, and dropping that bomb was one of them, and firing MacArthur was another one. You just had, in those days, these towering egos that one way or another had to be coped with, and yet they all had built a support group around them, and poor Mr. Truman didn't have any support group. And I remember Mrs. Truman, how everybody after Eleanor, you know, there's poor Bess, and Bess continued to belong to a bridge club back in Independence, Missouri, and she would bring them to the White House, and she was really Harry Truman's wife, and that's all she was. And when the daughter came along and was a singer of some talent, how upset Mr. Truman got when the critics criticized her singing. And But in the end, people could empathize with him because he was kind of one of them.
Yeah.
And yet you had to kind of shut your eyes to that whole machine that put him in politics and sustained him there.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to pick up on something that I think got left untouched, and that was the idea of his mother's influence, of Katie's influence. What was she to Sam that helped prepare Sam to take the interest of women seriously? I mean,
well, I think that because she was left behind when the colonel went to France in 19, whenever he went to World War I, and she had those children to rear, and she had to make business decisions for Sam's father, that decisions he probably wouldn't have made, but that she saved the family business in many ways. His father was pretty far extended in timber and one thing and another, investments that he had all over. And so Katie had to make business decisions as well as hold the whole family together in Berkeley. And communication was not very good in those days. Certainly instant communication, not at all, except by telegram, and those had to be cryptic. And that she held the fort while Sam's little sister, Patricia, died of the flu. And if you read Katie's notes, you recognize just how torn apart she was to watch this child die right in front of her eyes and not be able to do a thing about it, and watch her temperature go up and up and up, and if they could bring it down a little bit, she chronicled all of this. And the father never got home, even for the funeral. And so Katie was really the linchpin that held the family together and held the family business together. And that Katie kept the books, she kept her own books. She didn't do a lot of outside activities, that is, being active in things, except as she helped other people do it, helped this Mrs. Deal, and helped to in the YWCA in Berkeley. And she wasn't active on the board, but she backed a lot of things that they did. She backed a lot of Catholic charities, and they were her own. She was very independent. She and her father and Sam's father had their own charities that they gave to. She always kind of took Sam's part when the father would be too tough on him. And Sam started showing signs of gout, although they didn't know it, when he was only 14. And the colonel would expect Sam to continue right with all the physical activities that the father was so good at, hunting and fishing and golfing and boating and all that sort of stuff.
He showed signs of doubt at age 14?
Gout.
Gout.
Yeah.
Really?
That's that chronic gouty arthritis that is a hereditary disease. It's like
child.
Diabetes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he was a child. The father never admitted that Sam's was a hereditary case of gout, and that what he had was gout too. But he always passed it off as he just twisted his ankle or something. But he didn't have it as acutely as Sam did. And so I think Sam's mother maybe tried to overprotect Sam. And also they both had terribly high expectations of Sam's, but Katie's, it seemed to me, always was a little more human, and she understood the frailties. And particularly, very often mothers are closer to sons and fathers are closer to daughters. And maybe Katie just felt Sam needed protection. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But
so his dad would be pretty hard on him,
yeah,
his mother would intervene.
Yeah, right. And so I think that Kate and Sam respected her for what she had brought herself from, to what she had brought herself. And she was a good partner for Sam's father, but she wasn't aggressive as much as he was. But she went along with a lot of the things that he did. And he ran around with those fellows in San Francisco that had friends on the side, you know, and he was a timber broker for William Randolph Hearst, and all of the goings on that went on at various of Hearst's places. And Katie was, you know, physically she was not attractive, but in many ways she had a lot of character and a lot of quiet faith and courage and that sort of thing. And I don't know, Sam just, he'd been brought up with all women, mm-hmm. and governesses, and some of whom he liked a lot, and they were really great people in their own right. But I think the fact that Sam lived in Central Oregon a great deal of the time when he was growing up, and associated with the people up there, and got away from San Francisco. And then, as I started to say back a little ways, as I understand it, you know, during the days of Prohibition and the speakeasies and whatnot, and people drank too much, that Sam was injured in a terrible automobile accident, and his back was broken. And that was a terribly serious thing through which Katie nursed him back, and he really didn't lose that much, except that those injuries coupled with any injury causes flare-ups of gout made him very out of being able to be active for a little while.
Gout's very painful.
Very painful. I didn't know that much about it. When he and I were married, I, you know, we didn't talk about things like that. But I can remember when we lived in that motel in Redmond, his having such severe attacks of gout that we had to put a cardboard box, for example, over his foot because his ankle, because he couldn't even stand the weight of the sheets on it. It hurt so hard. Uh-huh. And he was, during those years, he was just going from one extreme attack of gout into another one.
Did it subside later?
Well, what happened was that he had, this Jack Wood had a daughter who was a godchild of Sam's, and when she was going to be married, Sam and I did a reception for her at the Francisca Club in San Francisco, and Sam was having an attack of gout in his knees so hard that he could hardly stand up, and even with the bigger trousers that men wore in those days, his knee was swelled so hard that, and he wouldn't be on crutches. He just wouldn't do it. And he was taking as strong pain pills as you could take orally. And even so, when the reception was over and he had barely managed to stand through the whole thing, everybody else went out for dinner and we were going to, but we went back to the hotel and had room service sent in because Sam was so miserable. But all that evening, the same doctor's name kept showing up from various people, including Mrs. Kenyon Joyce, the general's wife. And women were not known to have gout. At least they thought women didn't get it, that it was a men's disease, and just transmitted to male members of the family. And the same doctor's name kept showing up. And I said to Sam the next day, gee whiskers, you know, why don't we go see Dr. Kuzel? And just use, Mrs. Joyce said we could use her name. Why don't we do it and see if you can't get in to see him? And he was a rheumatologist who had an office down there on 450 Sutter Street in that big professional building. And so we did use Mrs. Joyce's name, and he did see us, and he was working with the Stanford Research people and the Geigy Pharmaceutical Company, and he was working on a new remedy for gout. And when we went in there, and he was no personality guy, but he said to Sam, I don't need any more patients, but with the kind of history you've got in the background, you'd make a wonderful number in my research file, because you've got a classic case of textbook case of hereditary gout, and you've been treated by Mayo's, and he named the doctors back there, one of whom got the Nobel Prize for his work discovering cortisone. And he said, I have told that doctor, whatever his name was, repeatedly that I disagree with him. I couldn't disagree with him more than that I do already, no matter what. He's on the wrong track. You're on the wrong track. If you want me to, I'll just puncture that knee to be humane, but you and I know it'll just come right back again. But I can just tell you, you come in here a 47-year-old man on crutches and as in bad shape as you are, you're going to be in a wheelchair very soon the rest of your life. And this isn't going to kill you,